Hi, and welcome to Talkward.
I'm Marty Dundix, editor-in-chief of Working Humorous Magazine, and this is Talkward, where hilariously funny people come and tell cringeworthy stories. And today I have special hilarious comedy writing guest, Andy Newton.
Hello.
Hey, Andy Newton, how are you?
Good. I'm very sweaty today. It's sort of entered that... It's finally entered that season where I'm just dripping in sweat all the time. You know, it's like it's muggy. You know, I grew up in California, so my body's like built for just a continuously temperate like 68 degrees. And if it's anything below or above, I'm just horribly uncomfortable all the time.
You need something that can wick. It's got to wick away.
Yeah.
Wick away the moisture.
I see all my clothes are cotton fabric. I'm just walking around.
That's what we need. We need a 100% sponge fabric shirt and pant.
But just, well, I guess sponges do wick away, but then you're carrying
they
around.
They absorb.
But then you're carrying around like 20 pounds of your own sweat
we
everywhere.
Would be very heavy in those sponge clothes.
Just this big inflated person walking down the street.
You poked a hole in my sponge cloth empire rather quickly. Damn it. I had already spent all those monies. Those commercials would have been great.
Yeah.
I'm going to mock up the product.
Yeah, you should. I think it's a good idea.
It's like
you
us wearing sponge.
It would
essentially
like
be SpongeBob SquarePants, but for human.
I have a feeling it would look a lot like a tampon commercial with like the side-by-side, like pouring water on a cotton t-shirt, pouring water on the sponge shirt.
Yeah.
With the blue liquid.
It's always the blue liquid.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I used to think that all women peed their pants. Because
and it was blue.
Because they use the same blue liquid in the tampon commercials as they do in the diaper commercials. So intuitively, as a kid, not knowing anything about menstruation, I just assumed that was some sort of key difference between men and women, as women never learned how to hold it in or they were physically incapable of doing it.
Well, you got conditioned poorly.
Yeah.
By television ads.
Yeah. I finally learned that they didn't, but it was only a
that
couple
was an
years
awkward
ago.
Conversation. Yeah. Thanks for coming on the show.
Of course, yeah.
You're a fan of the show. You've listened to it before.
Yeah, I've listened to all of them. Actually.
Oh my god, all of them.
Yeah. I have a lot of time to kill. I don't. podcasts are great. I love that. It's this weird technology that's kind of cyclical. We're into radio shows again. You know,
but it's, isn't it funny that people act like podcasts are this new amazing thing.
No.
And it's just radio.
Oh, yeah.
And then people do live podcast, and it is radio.
That's literally radio.
That's literally what radio has been.
And I guess not literally because it's not the signals, but it's over Wi-Fi
or
whatever. But
it's, it's funny.
And similar to, podcast hosts who people talk about. Like, I love Marc Maron's podcast.
Yeah.
But people sort of talk about him as if it's this sort of like new, how he embodies this sort of quintessential new figure that's never existed before, but he's essentially a broadcaster, like Larry King or Dick Cavett, you know? It's the same thing, it's just a slightly new format.
And they're like, who?
Yeah.
They had these shows on.
Yeah. People used to sit down with guests for longer than 5 minutes, and they would have conversations that weren't pre-scripted about whatever garbage movie
it wasn't
started.
Like 5 minutes of boring chatter about your new superhero movie.
Oh my god, I can't sit through any more Jimmy Fallon interviews. It's too hard.
I haven't been tuning in. I only see the clips when they're playing games. To me, it looks like the show has just become a bunch of games.
Yeah, it's kind of a kids show. But
yeah.
The one thing I do tune in for, and I sort of like watch everything on YouTube now. That's one thing that Jimmy Fallon actually understood, or someone on his staff understood really well, is that these talk shows, you can really, they lend themselves to the new sort of internet streaming generation of, media, in the sense that you can make it these sort of like little snackable segments, because the show is already built into these little snackable segments, you know.
Well, that's why Letterman got out, because he said he couldn't compete with the younger generation that was just making the show
with
to
these
be
newfangled gadgets.
Well, his show was more long form. It was more conversation,
yeah.
And then all the other shows they're almost being made so that people could digest them. Not on television, but online, maybe the next day.
Right.
Via
Facebook
or whatever.
Sitting on the toilet, yeah.
Exactly.
But, have you seen David Letterman's Netflix show, the new one?
I've only seen clips. I have to watch it because it looks great. Yeah, that it looks like a long form interview show.
That you can't watch in clips. It's right. It's just one really long interview. It's really good, and it's sort of perfect for Dave. The first few episodes were interesting because I thought, you know, he really doesn't give a lot of context for why he's sitting down with people. But the first few interviews were all focused on these, on humanitarians, and mm-hmm. like it was like Barack Obama, and they sort of they talked all about civil rights, and they did they did George Clooney, but they really didn't talk at all about his acting.
Yeah,
they did Malala, you know.
Yeah,
but now they did Tina Fey, who like you know she's no humanitarian, but she's a feminist in the sense that she's a woman who doesn't want to be enslaved. But
sure,
yeah, she's made a
qualifies,
lot of
qualifies, right?
Yeah. Oh, of course, yeah. I think people, that's like the trouble is people don't understand that that's really all that feminism is. It's just like, well, do you think women are inferior? Well, then you, like, well, the good. Then
I think there's varying degrees of
there
feminism.
There are, yeah. Oh. Well, most people.
You made things very black and white for a second there, Andy Newton.
Well, most people, when they, you know, this is like an old conversation, but most people, you know, think of, they hear feminist and they think of like the bra burning
right.
feminists in the 70s who, like, and. First of all, why is that bad? Like,
right.
You know, let the ladies burn their bras. That sounds fun, you know.
Sure.
Sounds like someone I'd want to hang out with, but yeah. That's just me.
Well, I feel like, especially back then, they were much more uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, these sort of, like, these men, these, like, straight men making bras that, like, don't know.
Oh, just overall clothes back in the day were uncomfortable. I'm a big Downton Abbey watcher. Just everything about clothing back in the day just was absolutely horrendously uncomfortable.
So much wool. Can you imagine?
So many layers of wool and like corsets and like just weird straps.
Oh yeah.
And oh yeah. Laces upon laces upon
like,
zippers.
Well, you know how like Mormons wear that weird underwear?
Yeah.
It's like everyone had that weird underwear back then. It's just so much such a hassle. You
I
know?
Can't
like
wait
strapping
for
into
the
a
future
space
when we're just all going to wear the same jumpsuits made of sponge material, maybe, when they figure out the weight problem with the water. But that'll be easy.
Yeah. If I could, I would think I would just wear like gym shorts and a t-shirt everywhere I went. But
well, I've seen these. They're kind of like dress up business casual sweatpants. They're sweatpants that have a taper. So they're a little bit cool,
uh-huh.
and they have a pant shape to it, but they're made out of sweatpant material.
They make them for men?
Yeah.
I need to look into this. I'm always really jealous. I feel like there's a disparity of formal and semi-formal clothing options between men and women.
Yeah,
you
definitely.
Know, like for men, it's like if you need to go to an office, you know, you have slacks and a collared shirt. That's really all you can get away with. There's really not a lot of... You really have to stay on those lines.
You're saying that you don't have the options of flair that you would like?
Not flair. It's just... It's more a question of comfort. You know, like...
Oh, okay.
Like on a hot day, you know, like I want my legs to be able to breathe a little bit, you know?
Oh, you want to wear a dress.
Yeah. Or something akin to the male version of
a
dress.
I mean,
like tights,
we used to have togas back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone wore the togas.
Oh, and then,
I'm totally on board with us going back to toga type situations.
Oh, totally. Or like Robin Hood with the tights. Like, that's nice and airy, you know?
Yeah, maybe tights.
Yeah.
No.
You're not a tights guy?
Well, just, I mean, imagine having to go to the... You have to pull them down and up all the time. Is there... Are we talking about...
How is that different from wearing pants?
I don't like wearing pants. I thought we were moving on from pants. I thought we were talking...
That's a good point.
I thought we were going beyond
you
pants.
You can hike up the skirt. Yeah. Hike up the toga.
Anyway, Andy Newton, you're a comedy writer.
We didn't complete the introduction.
I know. We're getting back to it. It's only been 10 minutes.
Okay.
You've been a writer for Weekly Humorist. You've written for Lampoon. You've written for McSweeney's.
McSweeney's, yes.
Split Sider.
And I have my... this is a good time to get a plug in.
New Yorker?
Not in the New Yorker.
Have you tried?
Yeah, we're just incessantly sending Emma Allen stuff, but I guess we're not erudite enough, or they run a lot of articles that are sort of painfully autobiographical about sad and tortured their...
As a writer, like, I don't write and submit to people, I get writers and I publish, so I am on the other side, and you deal with other people who are not me. And yeah, what sites do you, or what magazines, like, what's your opinion on the type of work that seems to always get accepted at certain types of places? So there's the American Bystander,
right.
There's McSweeney's,
yeah.
There's Weekly Humorist, there's Split Sider, there's Points in Case, there's Robot Butt, there's the Belladonna, and there's the New Yorker.
Yeah.
Is that pretty much it? Then there's a bunch of like kind of tertiary sites.
Yeah, yeah. That's really mostly what I'm aware of. Yeah, and it's my writing partner and I, and just me by myself, we really focus on
Michael.
Yeah, Michael Bleicher. Yeah.
Bleicher.
Yeah, not Bleacher.
I mispronounced it earlier.
You know, we focus on, you know, we're always trying, we're constantly trying to get into the New Yorker or McSweeney's. But we also love your site, and we most of the time we write stuff and just send it immediately to you because we know that,
Know that I'll just put it up.
Well, we know that it's like not a, you can tell when something's like not a fit. Like we just love vulgarity and we can't help ourselves. So we, and that's not something that McSweeney's and, or the New Yorker really trade in.
No, they don't.
But, you know, and, I'm kind of, you know, we try to sort of write things and come up with ideas that are suited to these publications we're trying to get into. But then the things that we end up getting published with McSweeney's, for instance, are never the things that we thought what they would pick up. It's just something that we sent them just on a whim. And so it's, I'm kind of like given up all hope in being able to sort of tailor my writing to a specific publication and just, you know, it's more worth it just to write whatever you want.
Well, one of the funniest things that I think that you and Michael wrote for Weekly Humorist recently was the McSweeney's themed piece, which I thought was just so funny.
Thank you.
I'm going to try to bring it up here so I can read some of these. But what was the title of that piece?
It was All of Our Rejected McSweeney Submissions, I think it was what it was called. That piece,
and
we had so much fun writing
of
that.
Of those joke possible articles, did you submit any of those to McSweeney's?
I think there may have been a couple that we had actually submitted to them in the past, but most of them are things that we came up with. It really started because Chris Monks had just rejected one of our pieces and we were feeling resentful about it, and so just the two of us
take things like that really personally.
No, okay. But it was just like,
what does he say when he rejects you?
He usually, for us, he usually says, I don't know what he says for other people, but he usually says for
just
us
a
like,
photo of a middle finger.
No, he actually gives a personalized response, which is really thoughtful. You know, like the New Yorker just sends the same form email to everyone. But he'll say, you know, and now that we have a little bit of a rapport with him, he'll say like, oh, this was, you know, a couple laughs here, but not quite there or something like that. Or, you know, he tends to think our pieces are very like humorous, but not laugh out loud funny, which is fair, I guess. So it was just, it really didn't even start as a thing that we wanted to write and submit. It was mostly that he and I were just like goofing off and coming up with the sort of like most stereotypical McSweeney's headlines that we could imagine.
And these really are. Do you have a favorite? It's Bedazzled Jean season, you fucking asshole.
that's
which
up
is
there.
The gourd, which is obviously
yeah,
kind the, of a parody
yeah, the decorative gourd season. Yeah, there are a couple that are very specific parodies, and then there are a lot of others that are just sort of things we come up with. I like the Salem Witch Trials one.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Where is that?
It's toward the bottom, I think.
I like list missed connection ads to my childhood crushes.
Which is then something we submitted.
Which then you wrote. You.
Yeah. Well, so actually, we actually wrote that and then submitted it to McSweeney's, and of course they rejected it. So then you printed
it. It's funny.
We were really attached to that piece, mostly because a lot of those stories were based on real things that had happened to us.
I'm in grad school and my life is sad.
We've noticed that there are a string of McSweeney's articles that are just about like the sort of tortured existence of a grad student.
Or like the tortured privileged person.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of mindset. List, yeah. Shania Twain song or Italian deli order.
Yeah, so that was
this is a good one. I'm a millennial and I'm not looking for toilet paper. I'm looking for a clean butt lifestyle. That's a good one.
Thanks.
Yeah, this was a great list. And to honor your list, I styled the page to look like McSweeney's font and
styling. That was really great. Yeah.
That took me all day. I had no idea how to do that.
How did you find the font and everything?
Oh, God, I don't know. It was a lot of Googling on CSS. It was all CSS. It's called CSS, guys. It's cascading style sheets. And
interesting.
They suck, and I hate them. And they are they're what controls everything on the web to look a certain way. And it yeah. makes all of your fonts and your colors and everything. And,
So I think, you know, we still sort of try to tailor things. What we'll do is we'll like be like, we need to write something to get into this publication, and we'll start yeah. out writing it, and then halfway through it, we'll have come up with a joke that we think is absolutely hilarious, but then we realize is not something we can that you know, McSweeney's The New Yorker would probably ever run, like something just really filthy, and we're like, well, let's just keep it in and send it to Marty, because like this, because the integrity of the piece is more worthwhile than
we can wait and we can make something that's a little bit more classy to send to them later.
Yeah,
send this to Marty now.
But then, you know, you never know. Like we just got a piece picked up by McSweeney's that we initially had written to be a New Yorker piece, and then they rejected it, and we're like, well, let's just send it to McSweeney's and see what they say. And they picked it up, which we actually weren't expecting at all. Back to my, you know, point about sort of just being completely unable to predict it. It's a piece called it may have come out by the time this you post this podcast. It's called the one where everything's 2018. It's like a list of Friends episode synopses that but all the characters are in 2018, so it's a lot of like current topical
okay.
references,
like modern Seinfeld.
Yeah,
which
kind
is
of.
A Twitter account, I think.
Right, yeah. So it's stuff like Phoebe joins Antifa and like
oh, that's fun
and it's stuff like that. So it's and that we had a lot of fun writing that, mostly because it's just
nostalgic. It's
yeah,
great.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we're just huge fans of Friends, and so
that kind of stuff really does amazingly well.
Oh
anything
yeah, people
nostalgic based.
Yeah,
people can attach to and they can relate to, and people go crazy. People share that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it was like sort of a, in retrospect, it was a perfect McSweeney's piece, because it's that intersection of nostalgia and current events, like topical humor.
Yeah, it is. That's,
so it just this it all comes
so that got accepted
together. Yeah, so that he'll run that in the next few weeks. Yeah, so we're happy about that.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
I wish I had it, but I am happy for you. So when you have something that has fart jokes, you know where to come.
All right. Yeah, definitely.
What's the time scale? If you get something on McSweeney's and you hear, how quickly do you hear from places? Like, how quickly do you hear from The New Yorker?
They all actually tell you, like, exactly how long it's going to take.
Really?
Yeah. So the New Yorker will get back to you. It takes The New Yorker 90 days to get back to you, which is awful. because and they request that you don't. I'm really burning a lot of bridges here.
it's nice to hear behind the curtain a little bit.
Yeah,
you know,
and these are all publications that I love to read, so it's not like I'm shitting on these people. But something like the New Yorker, they probably get like hundreds of submissions every day. I'm sure then that's what just
oh,
why it takes a
probably
long.
More thousands.
Oh yeah, I used to send the New Yorker submissions when I was like 12 years old, thinking that like, oh, they're gonna run this.
Bob Mankoff is gonna love this. It's written in crayon.
But I think I submitted something to them that was like a dialogue between two Amish people arguing over who was more humble.
This was when you were a little kid?
I think I was like 13 or 14 years old, and I submitted it to them. And then I was
such a nerd.
I was like, this is so cutting edge. Like, they're going to love it. It's so, and I don't even think I heard back from them about that. But so the New York takes 90 days, and they request that you don't send them anything until you hear back about the last one. So
in theory,
you could only send them like 4 things a year. So we,
that's interesting.
What we do is we send them pieces from different email addresses.
Sneaky.
I don't even know if they would notice if you sent them more than one.
Yeah.
Like, I think I mean, I'm sure someone's reading it on the other end, but
yeah.
It's really, you get a lot of auto replies. I've only ever gotten auto replies from them. Mm.
Is it like, thank you for submitting. If we accept it, you'll hear back within 90 days.
No, it's like there's like a form rejection they send everyone. And I think like if we ever got a rejection that was signed Emma Allen, I think that means that we're getting close, but we haven't gotten there yet. We haven't gotten the personalized rejection letter yet. Because I know that happened with McSweeney's.
Yeah.
We are sort of knocking on McSweeney's door for a long time and getting very impersonal responses. McSweeney's takes 2 weeks. They're really good about replying. And it's just that one. It's just Chris. It's just the one guy. And at a certain point, we got a rejection where he signed his name. And I was like, oh, he remembers us. Like, they were getting closer. And eventually...
Well,
like,
he typed his name.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it,
my mind, I thought you got like a letter a second.
Sincerely.
He wrote it with a quill. It arrived via bird. It was very nice.
But I think it's the difference between like copying and pasting a form rejection into an email and actually taking the time to write a response. And now he sends us... Now he'll send us like his actual thoughts on the pieces, which we actually really appreciate because we like feedback.
Dear Andy, I don't like you very much. You're like, I don't like getting this much information. I liked it better when it was a form.
You know, and then
I find you very sweaty.
With McSweeney's, there's really no telling how long it takes them once they accept something, how long it takes them to publish something, because. I only started publishing with them after Trump got elected, and that really like threw the whole humor writing thing on its head because
everything is so time sensitive.
Exactly.
It's insanely time sensitive.
And so he created
this
time sensitive email address you can submit pieces to. And so we've gotten a couple pieces picked up through that.
It's bullshit.
And so that we'll like send him a piece if it's time sensitive and he'll read it. And then respond in like a day and then publish it the next day.
Because everything...
And it's super fast. Because then it becomes irrelevant.
Everything's irrelevant.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a waste.
Yeah.
You know, I like funny stuff that's evergreen or at least relevant for like a month.
Or topical.
Oh, yeah, come just like, on, so, you know?
Some things that... Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the issue is...
You know, you get something where it's only funny for a day.
Right.
It's like, this is great, but it's only relevant for like the next 25 minutes. I can't possibly
and there's
use it.
And there's a question about how worthwhile it is even to write something like that, because do you want something that you can read on the day of and then it's funny, but then has no lasting power? You know, I kind of want to write something that you can revisit years later and still think is funny.
Exactly.
You know?
Basically, if something's only going to be funny for the next 6 hours, it's a tweet.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you can boil it into 240 characters, you know, post that.
And that might be what really the genesis of that is, just sort of humor, longer form humor writing, chasing the sort of the expectations that like social media has set up about joke writing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there is like, you know, you can write. I really love writing just sort of topical humor that isn't tied to a specific news story necessarily, but kind of just lampoons current events in general and sort of trends. Because there are just trends that last longer than
an
hour, you know. And so I sent a time sensitive piece to him and he replied once, I would have categorized this more as topical than time sensitive. And I was like, that's a good note. Thanks.
It's like you wrote urgent. This wasn't that urgent.
No, I wouldn't. Exactly. That is sort of the comedy writing equivalent of getting like an office email that someone's typed a bunch of exclamation points in.
Right.
You're like, this wasn't necessary.
This is not something that has to get my attention
until
tomorrow.
Waited. Yeah.
This could have waited. This comedy could have easily waited. This is not a comedy emergency, Andy. So what do you got coming up for article development? Like, so when you and Michael write together, do you throw a topic at him and then you guys go back and forth?
So sometimes it's pretty organic. Sometimes we'll just be chatting and we'll just be fucking around and joking.
And then do you guys write in like a joint, like Google Doc?
Yeah, we do Google Docs.
Okay.
And so we'll have the chat open and we'll chat and write together. And this is kind of something, this is a process that we developed years ago. So now it's sort of second nature to us. But
have you tried modern things like Slack? I've never used Slack, but I think that's
a thing.
I don't
want to do Slack.
No.
Yeah. Well, with Google Docs, it's so easy because there is a chat bar in Google Docs. So it's, sometimes we'll just be chatting like on Facebook or something or texting each other and we'll come up with an idea that way. Or sometimes one of us will come up with an idea and we'll float it past the other one. And then usually what we do first is we'll riff on it, you know, and we'll just sort of like throw jokes at each other and throw, you know, quotes and dialogue and stuff. And we'll pick out the good pieces and sort of put it all in this big sort of confused jumbly doc.
Yeah.
And then we'll go and we'll sort of like review all the stuff we came up with and then write like a first draft and then we'll read it over and cut out the fat and, you know.
I find the best things or the things that I like the most are things that could also be performed. I don't know why, but I don't like lists as much.
I get bored really fast with lists.
People send lists like nonstop, and they're funny, but mm-hmm. for some reason I would much prefer like to read something that is dialogue based or yeah. idea narrative where I could envision it happening.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of stuff that I really enjoy.
We write a lot of we're sort of similar. We end up writing a lot of monologues and mm-hmm. we really enjoy like character studies. Like we come up with like we come up with like a voice that we think is just really funny. And then we'll just sort of write a monologue from that voice.
The article you guys wrote of what's his name talking about Hope Hicks was one of the funniest.
Oh, Stephen Miller. Yeah, we were really proud of that.
Let me find that. Oh, that was good. Oh, that Paul Manafort thing you guys wrote was so funny too. You guys are really funny. I'm happy that you guys write for the site. Oh
thanks.
Man.
Yeah. We're happy to be writing for you.
This is the article is The Course of True Love Never Did Run Smooth and Other Entries from the Diary of Stephen Miller. And it's this like real sad entries of Stephen Miller and he's just pining over Hope Hicks, and it's written in such a way where it's like it's unveiling this obsession and love that he has for Hope Hicks and this jealousy that he is realizing that Hope Hicks has been dating this other guy.
Rob Porter,
who so gets thrown out of the White House. Yeah,
this was written around the time then with the whole Rob Porter stuff. Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah, we're really proud of that. And I think, you know, for that piece, we're also able to draw on a lot of experience of teenage angst and, you know, just really playing into that angle while also then mixing in the sort of, you know, proud white nationalism that Stephen Miller seems to embody.
Oh, this is funny. I can't even... Rob Porter is a goddamn cuck. Turns out Rob and Hope have been dating this whole time. Previous to that line, he's being really sad. He's like, you know, I kind of think I'd like Rob to be gone because I see him as competition. 2 seconds later, what? Infuriated. This is a funny article. If you're listening to this, please go to Weekly Humorist and look up all of the articles written by these guys because they are hilarious. That's a funny one.
Yeah.
But the Paul Manafort one, also super funny.
Thanks.
Where he's like slowly escaping.
Yeah. I like what he's taking. Yeah, he's sort of, it's the premise of the piece is that he's doing for like community service, for court mandated community service. He's hosting this sort of self-help seminar where, you know, they're doing this whole thing of like, you know, like he's doing kind of like the George Clooney up in the air thing of like, what would you pack in your suitcase? And he's like, well, let's look at my suitcase. We have, you know, 5 different passports.
You have all this cash.
Yeah, various currencies.
That is Paul Manafort's 7 Keys to a More Deliberate Life. And that's hilarious. You gotta check that one out, too. These are fun. Also, the thing that's fun about your articles is that it's fun to do the art for them.
Yeah, so I really appreciate the art you do. It's,
I always have much fun making the art for your articles because they always have the funniest characters in them. So I'm always like, ooh, what can I do? And I like try to put together something funny. And, yeah, you know, Paul Manafort running through airport terminal with a bag is great. And
you really
and Stephen Miller writing in his diary as like,
a little
kid.
I think my favorite one is when we wrote for the Lampoon, when we wrote... the Garfunkel Christmas piece.
Oh, that was fun.
That great silhouette of Garfunkel. That's
I got
really
to do some
just,
painting.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
I enjoyed it.
That piece was really special to us because the Garfunkel character is someone we've been writing for years. Like,
yeah.
It was something we came up with like maybe shortly after college, and we just had written, I think we'd written maybe, at this point, I think we've written over 10 of these monologues, and it's just kind of an inside joke between the two of us, and we were so... proud to have it finally published somewhere.
And this is Garfunkel of Garfunkel and Oates. No, Garfunkel. Garfunkel and Oates is the comedy singing team.
Simon and Garfunkel.
Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah.
Garfunkel and Oates is also very funny.
Yeah.
It's, they're and hilarious. And they the play great
of,
songs.
The premise of these monologues.
Simon and Garfunkel.
The premise of these monologues is just that Simon and, you know, Art Garfunkel goes around and tries to, you know, do everyday mundane things and keeps getting recognized. And everyone's just asking him about Paul.
Yeah.
And things that Paul Simon does. And he's like, I don't actually, you know, talk to Paul every day.
I don't really hang out with Paul so much anymore. Thanks, guys.
But he always, every piece that we've written, you know, no one would know this because there's only been one published widely, but every piece starts with, hello, I'm acting and singing legend Art Garfunkel, and I would... you know, dot, 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 or in the Christmas pieces. And I would like to return this sweater.
I would like to return this sweater. No, I don't talk to Paul that much. Why aren't you paying attention
I'm
to
not
me?
Actually familiar with the individual tracks on Graceland.
And also, spurring from other articles you've written, you're now trying to make a book out of an article that started online.
Yeah, it started.
How is that going?
Well, so the book is finished. It took about a year to write. We so it's the genesis of it was shortly, I think it was maybe shortly after the 2016 election, or maybe I can't remember if it was before it actually. It was but it was around the stuff that it was around the time that the Russia stuff was in the news. We wrote this dialogue between Donald Trump and his Russian handler Petrov.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the spy who came in from the Access Hollywood bus, and that piece kind of spawned this idea of writing a whole book about the 2016 election. That it follows this very sort of lazy, incompetent reporter who gets assigned to cover the election and is trying to use his assignment as a way to get an all-expenses-paid trip to San Diego for he and his wife for their anniversary. And so it's partially like a road novel. You know, it follows he and his wife sort of on the campaign trail and, you know, running into, you know, crazy Trump voters and conspiracy theorists. And then throughout it, there's interspersed these dialogues between Trump and Petrov that sort of point to this ever-evolving, you know, plot to throw the election that then comes into play in the main narrative.
How long is the finished book?
It's actually pretty long. It's 100,000 words, which is like 300 pages, I guess, or around three. Or a little
That's
over
not
300.
Too much.
No, it's
especially if you're using real big font.
In terms of in terms of trade publishing, like trade fiction, it's on the longer side. You know, they want books to be between 75,000 and 100,000 words. The first draft of it was 120,000 words. And it was like, and that's just because we love writing these like really tangential episodes that have nothing to do with the story at all. Just, and so we had to cut. So we had to cut a big portion of it out to get it in a place where it was actually marketable.
Did you cut out any side stories that have characters that are completely cut out of the book?
Yes, actually.
Who? What's the character that got completely cut out of your unpublished novel? Who made it to the cutting room floor?
Gary Johnson.
Oh, Gary Johnson. You son of a bitch.
We had this whole chapter of we had this whole chapter where Harold...
Is Jill Stein in there?
No, but there's good. There's someone who's there's an orthodontist named Jill Stein who Harold the protagonist thinks is the Jill Stein because
gotcha.
They're both doctors. But there was a chapter that we had a whole chapter where Harold goes to the libertarian debate and it's like him and like three other people in the mm-hmm. audience and Gary Johnson stoned and just kind of rambling on these talking about like Pink Floyd laser shows and stuff.
And that got cut out
because we, you know, it never really comes back in.
Yeah.
And so we figured it wasn't worth it.
It wasn't essential to the storytelling.
Yeah. I mean, I think cuts like that were really cut you to the heart, you know, because
put it back in. You're still shopping the book around. The editor cut it out.
What we've said is, well, the thing is,
you know, because what if the editor's like, you know, I really like that Gary Johnson part.
Well, the problem is that, you know, we're trying to find an agent for the book right now.
Yeah.
We actually have a nibble recently. We had this agent who liked our last McSweeney's piece, the Carter Page one,
mm-hmm.
Wanted to read the manuscript.
Yeah, the Carter Page thing was really good.
Thanks. Yeah. So we
wish I published it. That's the funny thing about all of these things is you get this FOMA.
Yeah.
FOMO. It's all about fear of missing out when it comes to these like one of the most annoying things I think I ever had happen was. You guys published something I really loved and I didn't have time to accept it and you went to Splitsider with it and it was the Sheets after the election?
No, so that the Sheets one, that was I wrote that by myself and that got published with McSweeney's.
And that was the one.
It was a time-sensitive one. Yeah, I can't remember
it was time sensitive.
I can't remember if people leapt on that or not.
It was totally time sensitive. So it was I think you sent it to multiple places at the exact same time.
Yeah, which I guess is not like.
And I think it was
appreciate
like
that.
I got it a Wednesday night, and I was going to respond to it Thursday morning, and then Thursday like before I could write you, it was, oh, this got accepted someplace else. And I was like, son of a...
That happened a couple times.
That actually happens a lot.
And actually, you know, and now we don't do simultaneous submissions anymore. Just because I feel like it kind of pisses people off.
It is a fear of missing out. So people will pay attention to you next time and they'll say, I really want that guy's stuff.
That did happen a couple times. And actually, one of the pieces went to you. Mm. You got it first. It was How to Be a White Ally Without All the Hassle.
Yeah, that's a funny one.
I sent it to you know, Brian Boone, you and Chris Monks, and you picked it up first, and then I you know, emailed Chris about it, and he was really angry that
really?
I sent it to someone else. Yeah. I think he punished me for a couple months before.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. I feel like what a lot of writers do is they try to really do close readings of editors' emails to see is he mad at me? Trying to parse the syntax.
You got
to
check that tone.
Yeah. But, you know, most of the time this is normal people who...
I try to skip all that. I just write everything in caps. All the time.
So you're either exuberant or just pissed off. Yeah.
I'm always having a heart attack.
So we have an agent who's reading it right now. We're kind of waiting to hear back.
That's exciting.
Yeah. We're hoping that we can get another couple sort of high profile things published just to say look how marketable we are.
Yeah.
Cause that's really that's why we had to cut down the words too, is that agents, they want something to be as little work as possible, you know? So they want authors with a built-in platform, and they want a book that they don't have to work with the authors to really edit down. So they just want something they can just send out the door immediately.
Is this an author that has a gigantic social media following where they can market this book themselves? Because I don't really want to do anything. Because there are these people that self-publish their books and they have this crazy following.
Oh yeah. The guy who wrote that Matt Damon movie, the book that the Matt Damon movie is based on, the one about Mars.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The one about Mars, where he's farming.
The Martian.
The Martian.
I should have thought of that. That's a really obvious title.
Yeah.
That was self-published, which I didn't realize. Then the book got picked up by a major publisher when it started selling a lot.
How nice for them.
Yeah.
Oh, you've already done all the work? I think I'll be your publisher now.
I think we'd like to pick this up. Yeah. So that's kind of what we're dealing with. We've been writing some short stories that involve the characters from the novel, just as kind of a way to explore the fictional world we've created further. And
That's awesome.
And in the hopes that maybe if we get one of these stories published, we can be like, hey, look, it's related.
What's the process of trying to get a book published? From guys who have, you guys have never been published as authors in a book way.
And
so this is your first attempt.
Yeah.
So you have a book and you wrote the book, and now how are you finding publishers? Are you looking on LinkedIn? Are you finding books that you like and you say, okay, it's published by Macmillan, and you go to Macmillan and you say, who's the guy at Macmillan I need to talk to? Do you hunt people down on the internet? Twitter?
A little bit. I mean, so when we started the process, we had just sort of blindly walked into it because really not knowing how to do it correctly at all.
Yeah.
And actually, New Yorker cartoonist and Weekly Humorous cartoonist Bob Eckstein.
Award-winning cartoonist
and
New York Times best-selling author.
Exactly.
Bob Eckstein.
I got a meal with him, and he actually gave me a lot of advice that really helped us start doing things the way people are supposed to do them.
Was it a good meal?
Yeah, we went to this real funky place in Chinatown that he described. He said, I love this place. I take all my meetings there.
All right.
And they did know him there.
Oh, really?
And he was actually bragging about how he lobbied them to put something on the menu.
Was it a good thing to put on the menu?
Yeah, well, no, actually, so it was something that was on the menu, but he lobbied to have them put it on the happy hour menu.
Oh.
So it was cheaper.
That I can support.
Yeah, and it was really good. So you really, you know, for major publishers, you really can't just email an editor there. There's they have this, you know, all these built-in gatekeepers. That's what the agents are sort of. So you really, you know, you can, there are a lot of independent and small presses that, mm-hmm. That you can, as a writer, you can send things into unsolicited. But what we're doing is, you know, we're sending to those people. We're also looking for an agent who has the connections to these big publishing houses. And you can find, you know, lists of agents on various websites. If you just Google, you know, there's like
on the dark web, Andy.
There's like
while you're busy looking for people's social security numbers, you're looking up agents' home phone numbers.
Yeah, trying to buy, you know, opiates and child slaves. Yeah. And there's like Poets and Writers magazine. They list things. Writers Digest has a big list of them.
Well, what's the imprint that does more of like the smart humor books? Like, is there a specialty imprint that does that kind of stuff?
You know, there might be. I just don't know it. You know, that's the humor. Their humor books tend to be like novelty books more than like humorous fiction.
Yeah, I don't mean like bathroom readers.
Yeah.
like you might be a redneck if type
right.
books.
I don't,
not
I
really.
Can't, I don't really know of any imprints that specialize in humorous fiction, like the kind of stuff that like, I guess like Tom Perata would write, but.
Well, like Steve Martin writes really funny kind of books.
Yeah.
That are like novellas type things.
Right. He had the Cruel Shoes book. But that was like back in the 70s.
I mean, he wrote, you know, like The Pleasure of My Company, but that's more of a story. But yours is kind of a story.
Oh, it's a story, yeah.
But I mean, there's a book called, it's about Trump, not Cheeto President. what am I thinking of? But the illustration for the cover is Steve Brodner. It's really fantastic.
It sounds kind of familiar.
I'm thinking it's the writer from, not Rolling Stone, Matt Taibbi?
He's the Rolling Stone
editor. He wrote a book about Trump, and it was kind of a satire, kind of like in-your-face type.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember what it's called. Damn it, I'll Google it, but it was something clever.
Yeah, to all the listeners at home, just Google Matt Taibbi Trump book.
You know, I actually have a computer in front of me. I could probably just look this up.
Yeah, so if you can find lists of
speaking of,
stuff.
If you're just tuning in, this is Talkward. I'm Marty Dundix, editor-in-chief of Weekly Humorist. I'm in conversation with Andy Newton, who's a satire writer. Thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
No problem.
So like, and agents, different agents have, you know, specialized in different things because I think a big part of being a literary agent is just having, you know, connections in the publishing world. And so most literary agents will have certain genres that they really only, you know, pick up books in. So
it's called Insane Clown President. That's what it was called.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay, go on with your stuff.
And so usually if you go through, you know, these agency websites, they'll have little bios about all the agents, and you pick the one who lists interests that sound similar enough to your book, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the game. It's very time consuming and very boring. And it's a lot of sort of knocking on doors and not.
Well, that's
back
similar. I mean, when I was shopping my portfolio around, when I was an illustrator,
mm-hmm.
and I had to go to all these art directors, and this was before throwing everything on the internet, you actually had to had a physical portfolio, like a big black book with a zipper, and it had little tear sheets in it,
right.
And you had to drop them off at the mailroom entrance of the magazine,
mm-hmm.
and then you would pick it up the next day, and you never even knew if the art director was looking at your stuff.
Yeah.
So sometimes you would do little tricks where you would like, you would maybe like tape a page together, or you tape like a hair
mm-hmm.
to see, and then you'd see if they even
like
opened
the James Bond trick,
yeah,
and Goldfinger.
Yeah, you would see if they even opened it, and that kind of stuff. Or I would like put little jokes inside to see if they would take, like I would put like a funny
That's
gift
a good
type
idea.
Thing. Yeah,
I kind of wish I could have experienced that, like the analog era of that, where you could.
It was tricky.
You could literally like go into a building and just go up and down the halls, knocking on people's doors. Like,
yeah,
you know, like
I did, like the Mad Magazine building that's now moved to Los Angeles or California. Mm-hmm. I think they're in LA now, Hollywood.
Yeah, I don't know.
They moved to the DC Comic building, I believe. But Mad used to be on in Midtown for years and years, and they were across the street from Letterman. And I dropped off my portfolio to Sam Viviano, the art director, and I got to like go in, and I didn't force my way in, but I brought a box of donuts, so they let me in, and because I bribed them with donuts, they let me hang out.
That's
and I
awesome.
Was just out of college, I just graduated from Syracuse, and I mm-hmm. had no idea what I was doing, and I just kind of shoehorned myself into this guy's office, and he let me come back like two more times.
That's great.
As long as I brought donuts.
Yeah, and that's the thing. That's sort of one of the challenges of the internet age is that. There's sort of a depersonalizing aspect of it where people are just an email address, and it's really, you know, there's no like sense. You can't really get a sense of people.
I like meeting the writers.
Oh, it's a lot of fun.
But I don't. Like, so many of the writers don't...
Though they live all over the place. Yeah.
But also, they're not social. Like, I invite them to stuff, and they just never come.
I think writers tend to be homebodies, yeah.
They can always come to the Guaranteed Delivery shows.
That's true.
Next show coming up June 4th at 110 Wall Street, 8 p.m., free tickets.
I can attest the shows are very fun.
You're going to come to the next one.
Yes, I will.
So far, we have Nico White, Ginny Hogan.
Did she do another show?
She's a writer. Stuff that I've seen.
That's
is,
where I've
she's
seen,
a New Yorker writer.
Yeah, okay.
She's a Belladonna writer. Yeah. She does. She's.
Yeah, I knew the name looked. I knew the name sounded.
McSweeney's writer.
I knew the name sounded familiar.
But she's been on Weekly Humorist, and she also does stand up. So she's going to perform at that show.
That's great.
Adam Mamawala, who's a stand up, he's going to be at that show. Django Gold, who is a writer for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
Cool.
He's going to be there. And it's actually going to be a show that's going to celebrate the issue of The Writer magazine, which is the June issue of The Writer magazine, is, I think, going to be on newsstands now. And there is an entire section. There's an article written by Keisha Whitaker, who wrote an article called The Lords and Ladies of LOL. It profiles the New Yorker. It profiles McSweeney's. It profiles Splitsider with Brian Boone. It talks to the Belladonna editors. It talks to Robot Butt. And it talks to me.
Yeah, and two columns, a whole page.
And they talk to Kit Lively. And they talk to Bob Eckstein.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I saw that they were quoted in the article.
Yeah.
That's great. That's exciting.
Yeah. So... everybody has to come. So you have to come to that one.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to get hopefully some free booze. I think there's going to be like a happy hour before the show that's also going to be sponsored. Courtesy of Swill. Go to getswill.com. They're actually one of our sponsors. Use coupon code DRINK5 and get $5 off your first order. Swill, getswill.com. It is a liquor store in your pocket. Thank you very much.
Have you noticed that every podcast is sponsored by the same companies?
I've noticed that everybody seems to be sponsored by Audible.com or Squarespace.
Audible, Squarespace is a big one. Parachute Sheets is a new company that I feel like.
So I should be getting them as a sponsor?
You should look for them. Yeah. My girlfriend just bought me a robe of a robe.
Whoa,
Parachute
whoa!
Sheets.
Don't brag so much. My girlfriend.
She buys me stuff. Yeah. I got a parachute robe. It's really comfy.
Is it soft? I've really seen the ads on the subway.
Yeah.
The people in the ads look very comfortable.
I was lounging in it last night. It is very comfortable.
How nice for you.
Yeah, and let's see, what else are the big ones? Plated or no, Blue Apron.
Blue
Apron service.
All the things that people get you to sign up subscription services for. That's what they really want you to do.
I don't know what it. People just love subscription services right now. I don't know what it is. I think people just. It's easier for people to sort of justify small monthly payments, I guess. But
they add up.
Yeah, they do add up. Yeah,
because I'll go in and start. You know. Wondering where all my money is, and it's because I keep on subscribing to things I forget that I've subscribed to.
I mean, it's like the Friends episode where Chandler's trying to quit the gym, you know. It's like this.
It's very true.
Yeah.
You love Friends. I'm seeing this.
Big Friends fan.
Yeah. Do you watch it on reruns? Where is it on reruns right now if I want to watch Friends?
Oh, it's all on Netflix.
Okay, so you watch it on Netflix.
Yeah, I used to, you know, it used to be syndicated every day at like 7 and 7:30 on Fox. And I used to watch. Same with
Nick at Night. I think it's on Nick at Night.
Yeah, it's also on Nick at Night. Yeah. You know,
that's when you know you're old.
Yeah, exactly.
When like the shows that you think are modern are now on Nick at Night.
That blew my mind when Friends was added to Nick at Night. I'm like, how? Like, it's like the same programming with like I Love Lucy and Designing Women,
right?
You know. but back before it was so old that no one would want to watch it unless you were, you know, on Medicare. They would, it'd be like 6:37 Friends, 7:30 Seinfeld. And like, that was like every day throughout like middle school and high school, I'd just like park my butt down and watch all these syndicated sitcoms. And it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
So what's your, awkward story you get to tell me, Andy Newton?
You're
always full of awkward stories.
Oh my God. Yeah. I'm just just an awkward existence. But, the one that I still feel damaged by, I haven't gotten over it yet.
So I like this.
I'm going to share it here.
This is starting off well.
In the hopes that it'll have some kind of therapeutic purpose. So this was back in college. It was right after that big earthquake happened in Haiti. Okay. That sort of it just obliterated everything. Like, it's really a terrible disaster. The story's already off to a funny start. Some group at the college I was...
How did all the terrible, hideous things that happened to these people in Haiti affect your life? Yeah.
Like, that
Andy.
Was really terrible, but just wait until you hear of the story.
Just wait what happened to
By
me.
Comparison, it'll seem, yeah.
I had bad dreams.
So some group at the college was putting on this really big open mic night that was going to raise money for, for the victims of the earthquake. And so everyone was signing up, and they're even getting like professional comedians to show up and everything. And so I signed up to perform some songs. Like, I used to, write songs, and so I sign up and I get a spot. It's like a big sort of like 3-hour event. It's like everyone's signing up for it. And so I get to the event, and it's in like the largest auditorium on campus. It's packed, like 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like sitting in the back, and quickly, what starts happening is, someone will perform, and then the host will come out and say who's next to come up. And then the person's like all the way in the back of the theater and can't get up to the stage in time, and they just move on to the next person. And so
so it's like a sprint.
Yeah. So everyone's like, people start like really hurrying down there to get there in time. And, you'd think like the person would say like, oh, on deck is right. This person. So the person's ready. But no, that didn't happen. And so I know I'm going to like...
If that had happened in The Sound of Music, the Von Trapp family singers would have just been caught by the Nazis immediately.
Yeah. The movie would have ended.
Would have ended very badly.
Yeah. And so I'm getting like nervous because I'm like, I don't want to miss my slot. So I have my guitar in hand. I'm waiting in the back of the theater. And then the host comes out and he calls my name, and he's looking in the crowd like, Andy, are you here? Like, going once. And I start sprinting down the center
Did
aisle.
Did you start yelling? Like, I'm here.
I'm like, I'm here.
I start
sprinting down the center aisle, heading towards the stage. And I still don't quite know why I did this. I think it was instinctual, but, it was a theater. So it was like, theaters are sometimes slanted.
Yeah.
So I'm running down, and from my, relative to my angle, the stage looked not as high as it truly was. And so I thought in my head, oh, I can just leap onto the stage and it'll be fine. And instead I make a running leap with my guitar in hand. I get about as high as my knees, just hit the stage, and I go sliding across the stage. Guitar flies out of my hand. There's like a huge audible gasp followed by a deafening silence.
I forgot you were carrying a guitar during all this.
The guitar made like this like loud like sound, and just like a loud gasp followed by an even louder silence, if that's possible, like a deafening silence. And I'm like, oh crap. I pick up the guitar, and I set up my chair, and I sit down, and I make some kind of offhand remark about how I wanted to do a Chevy Chase style pratfall. Of course, not realizing that not everyone, most 19-year-olds aren't very well versed in classic comedy.
No.
So that didn't get a laugh.
No.
So the tension, rather than being diffused by my joke, was just heightened.
Were they just like uproariously laughing at you at this point, or were they all kind of silent, like shocked?
I think they were like, I think everyone was just uncomfortable.
Yeah. Because
everyone viscerally felt my embarrassment. And so then I go, oh, I'm going to play the song. I start to play the song. I get two measures in, and I realize my guitar is horribly out of tune. So I stop and I'm like, my guitar is really out of tune, right? And I get this huge applause.
Good.
And so I'm like, okay, this is terrible. And so I'm just like shouting in the audience, like, does anyone have a guitar? Like, no one wants to help me out.
Does anybody have a guitar?
And I know there's, like half the audience has guitars. Oh. We're at an open mic.
Gotcha.
And so I'm like shouting in the audience, no one wants to help me. And I see a guy in the front row holding a guitar, and I kind of force him to give me his guitar. I'm just like, hey, you have a guitar. Give it to me. And I play the song and get off. And then
what was the song?
It's a song I had written.
Oh, that's even worse.
Yeah. It's like, then you're really putting yourself out there.
Putting yourself out there. Like, at least if you had started playing like Simon and Garfunkel songs, right. People at least would know what the heck you were playing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Man,
you really compounded things poorly.
Oh, yeah. And then so the very next act after me was the professional stand-up comic. And of course, the first thing he does is just lay into me.
Yeah.
And it gets, you know, just just the loudest laughter you'd
ever. Well,
that's
good. Kinda.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't in on it.
You get to laugh at yourself a little bit.
Yeah, so now...
You became kind of the hero.
I guess. I don't know.
As long as he wasn't... Was he, like, really mean jokes at you?
I wasn't in on the joke.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the... you know, but, like, if I were in his shoes, I would have done the exact same thing. I don't fault him for making fun of me. But I have not forgiven the people of Haiti yet.
Remind me again how this is Haiti's fault.
We're raising money for.
That's right. It's a fundraiser. Do you feel better now that you've told that story?
Yeah, I feel like a weight's been lifted.
Really?
Yeah.
Lots of people are going to hear it, and they're all going to know that you did this.
I think I can live with it. I've done a lot since then.
I've done a lot of terrible things, a lot of embarrassing things, much more embarrassing things have happened.
Way more embarrassing, horrible.
Have you ever played that song again that you wrote?
You know, not in public.
Really? Have you played it for the girlfriend?
No.
And the cat?
No, I have not played it for the girlfriend and the cat, no.
What's the cat's name?
Charlie.
What's the girlfriend's name?
Leah.
That sounds lovely.
Thanks.
I remember when we had dinner downstairs.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun.
That was a lot of fun.
We need to do that
and
again.
You picked up the check, yeah.
I did. That really that's never going to happen again, but yeah, all right.
Before we sign off, I do want to put in a plug for one thing we didn't
Please,
talk about.
Please, plug.
So my brother and I run an Instagram account called Wins From Behind.
Oh, I love that account.
Yeah. We publish scatological poems. So poems
I didn't
about,
know that was you and your brother.
Poems about farts and poops. And we publish daily. You should follow us on Wins From Behind on Instagram. We're also on Twitter and Facebook, but it's sort of primarily an Instagram account.
I did not know that you were on Twitter and Facebook. I know that you're on Instagram because I see them all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the Twitter account's kind of useless because it's just links to the Instagram.
Yeah.
They don't really mesh well, but the Facebook and Instagram interact really
well.
Oh,
we hardly even talked about your poetry, but we'll talk about that next time. But the Wins From Behind is funny because you label them movement number.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious because it's movement
yeah.
and it's fart related toilet humor. And it's also so high comedy, low comedy in there too. It's very
I mean the basic from since this is like a writer's podcast, I'll get into a little bit of the craft
sure.
of it. You know, really what makes it inherently funny is the fact that you're taking poetry, which is written in sort of, in literary terms, it's called like a high register. It's very, mm-hmm. you use very lofty language, you know,
right.
It's the, language of the bard. And then, but you're talking about this content, like the subject matter that's really low register, you know? So
yes.
it's a humorous contrast. And now that
it
I've
is.
Explained the joke, the thing will never be funny again.
Never again. It's very funny and it's very classy. And then you also got featured for poetry for WNYC recently.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was Poetry Month.
April was National Poetry Month.
And you wrote something about Queens, I believe.
Queens in the springtime.
Queens in the springtime, and you got featured. I saw that.
Yeah, yeah. They were doing this sort of weekly thing where they were like, they were giving people themes to write poems around, and they say like, oh, if we like your poems, we'll put them on the website.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a little thing about spring and sent it in, and they put it on their website, and I was really proud.
That was great.
Yeah, it was exciting, yeah.
And where can people follow you on Twitter? Because you guys post things on Twitter a lot.
Yeah, so we're, my writing, Michael Blacker and I have a joint Twitter account because we're both lazy, and each of us individually could never tweet enough to sustain one account. So we're Blacker_Newton.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then your next... And your next piece is going to be in McSweeney's
at some point
soon.
Yeah, it's very vague. It's like sometime in the next month.
Okay, well, we'll be looking for that.
Yeah,
and I'll get this up, and people can find links to. I'll put the links for the Wins From Behind and your Twitter account on the site for the Talkward thing, and we'll do that. And I'll see you at the show on June 4th.
I won't miss it. Yeah.
Okay, that's going to be great. Guaranteed delivery. Well, thanks for listening. This has been Talkward. I'm Marty Dundix, editor-in-chief of Weekly Humorist magazine. Please check us out at weeklyhumorist.com. Sign up for the weekly e-newsletter that comes out every Friday. Also follow us online at Weekly Humorist and on Instagram. This podcast is sponsored by Swill. Go to getswill.com. It's a liquor store in your pocket. Use code DRINK5 for $5 off your first order. Hey, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.